This is R.J. Rushdoony, Easy Chair number 420, October 23, 1998. This evening, Douglas Murray, Mark Rushdoony, and I will consider the relationship of two very important things, politics and religion. Now, the implications of this are far-reaching and have a meaning far outside the frontiers of both politics and religion. One of the movements that at the end of the last century, the beginning of this one, became very popular was one that summed up its message in the words, art for art's sake. And its point was that art need have no meaning, that it was sufficient that it was done as something related to art. Now this idea has spread or seeped into one area after another. We have science for science's sake, research just for the sake of research. We have, in one sphere of life after another, the feeling that there need be no relationship to life in general, nor any justification in terms of the world at large for a particular area of thinking and studying. Now, this kind of thinking has dominated the 20th century. It is very deadly, very dangerous. Politics always has historically had a meaning beyond itself. In fact, the meaning in every sphere was seen as a religious one. What was the meaning of life? Why did people do a certain thing? How could they justify it in terms of a religious faith? Our failure to relate religion and politics has been disastrous for the modern age. I'm going to tell a little story, a true one, that occurred in October of 1987. I was at Oxford for a conference, and one of the persons in attendance was a young rector in what I would guess was a suburb of Oxford, and he had had an interesting experience the previous Sunday night. He had been preaching in the evening services on some of the basic doctrines of the faith. And that Sunday, his subject at evening prayer was a rather unusual one and not commonplace in unreformed churches. It was simply this: politics and original sin. What he did was to develop the relationship of the fall of man to politics. Well, as he prepared to speak, he saw a couple of older members come in, and with them, Margaret Thatcher and her husband. And he felt a little upset. He thought he could have preached on a more popular and appealing subject if he had known that she was going to be there. As he later learned, she was visiting this other couple, friends, and it was her custom to go to evening prayer, and so she assumed they would take her, and so they did. Now, what this young rector preached on was that we have an idealistic and unrealistic approach to politics if we believe that it can solve problems in spite of the fact of man's sin, his total depravity. And as he developed the subject, he pointed out clearly that man in every area of his life and thought reveals what he is. Is he a sinner saved by grace, a redeemed man, capable therefore of bringing the light of the faith into that area of life? Or was he simply an unredeemed man, a sinner, depraved, assuming that by his goodwill he could change the world, alter the course of politics, and make a good society with bad men? As the old saying has it, you cannot make a good omelet with bad eggs. And this was, in essence, the point he was making. Well, he went ahead and preached his sermon. At the end of the service, after the benediction, he said, he raised his head, opened his eyes, and saw Mrs. Thatcher come charging down the aisle. And she came up to him, grabbed him by the hand, and shook it vigorously, and said, "Young man, if more people understood the meaning of what you were talking about, we would not have the false expectation of politics that is today universal." Well, I always thought better of Margaret Thatcher after hearing that story. She obviously is a woman of some depth and insight. Now, you cannot have a good omelet with bad eggs. You only have a bad omelet. And you cannot have a good social order if the people in the political order are fallen and depraved men. Men who have one desire to get what they want, and under a facade of idealism are doing every evil they can to further their own desires. This is why I believe the subject of politics and religion is so important. Now, you cannot create a good omelet with bad eggs, which means our expectation today that with the kind of people we have in the electorate, with as little religion as they have, we are filled with false expectations when we expect that somehow our politics will be good because our intentions are good. And the result is the chaos that marks modern politics. I'll stop there for a few moments. Douglas, would you like to comment on the subject?
Well, the corruption of art and various other things in our culture is kind of a long-standing issue. Kings back in the medieval times were patrons of the arts, and this seems to have been carried up into modern day. Now we have institutionalized patronage by governments, and we are all forced to donate our tax dollars to dubious artistic endeavors, and they have become corrupt because there's so much money involved. people who are not really artists, but con men have learned how to milk grants out of the U.S. federal government, and I'm sure the same thing extends to other Western governments as well. Science has become corrupted by politics because they too sustain themselves with federal grant money. The universities have become corrupted, as we found with through Paul Biddle and his work at rooting out the corruption at Stanford University. Our academy has become corrupted by relying on grants, huge grant money, and they've learned to live off of it. They've become experts at milking the federal government for money for projects that they conveniently say, well, it's going to be pure research, and from this some good will come. And this is a complete turnabout from the efforts in this country during the 19th century, where inventors and various people were trying to solve problems using basic scientific approach, trying to make people's lives better by coming up with technological advances that would that were work-saving, that had practical application. In every area that you can think of, every time the people ask the government to solve a problem, you get more of the problem, without exception. There's there's nothing you can find. I defy anybody to come up with anything that the people have asked the government to do, or any job that the government has taken on of its own volition, where they have solved a problem. In every case, they've made it worse.
Mark?
Well, whenever I think of the subject of politics and religion, you always think of what people say, well, you've got to keep your religious views out of politics, and you know, we're a religiously pluralistic society, and you can't impose your religious ideas on, you can't legislate morality. And in the beginning of Institutes of Biblical Law, you pointed out that all law is religious, and it's inescapably religious. When you legislate something, you are saying that it's good and we want to promote it, or it's bad and we want to disallow it. So even a stop sign is a moral law. You're saying that you don't have the right to endanger someone else's life, therefore we determine that you must yield the right of way at this intersection. So laws can promote one faith, one aspect, one idea of morality, one concept of morality. For instance, the environmentalists are trying to enforce their idea of what is moral. It may not be Christian, it may not even be good science, but it's their idea of what is right, and that's why they feel so self-righteous about what they do. And if you believe a certain way, you want the law to reflect your morality. So we can't escape the fact that, that law is religious and politics is dealing in the realm of morals and religion.
Well, the basic concept of law came from religion. You know, this is not an invention of man. It's become corrupted because man has become confused about where law came from and who's in charge. And we've got anarchy, moral anarchy as a result.
If we don't begin with a biblical perspective, we will end up with false religions controlling politics, art, and everything else, because sooner or later men are going to come to a religious perspective on everything. But their religion can be totally false. I recently heard portions of a lecture by someone on the necessity for Americans and other peoples of seeing that science gets an ever-increasing amount of public funding. He had in mind in particular Mars. What we have done is just scratched the surface, he said. We've got to carry on exhaustive research and go over the whole of Mars from one end to the other so that we have a thorough knowledge of its history, more thorough than possible here, because you would have all kinds of people protesting, infiltrating their preserves or their property rights and the like. In other words, there would be no end to the extent of their exploration of Mars. Now that is religious. But the kind of religion that prevails today is increasingly a humanistic one. Not a godly one, but a humanistic one. And so we have a growing problem in that our social order is increasingly in the hands of men who are essentially anti-Christian and who want to use the whole of the social order to explore things that are in terms of their religious faith. And the results are devastating. All you have to do is watch PBS at times when they have something on science in the schools to see what passes for science in our public education. And it is totally alien to everything that our Christian civilization and background espouses and practices. So, the subject is an exceedingly important one now, because another religion is being established and is gaining vast public funding. And all this, a religious thing in the name of science, not religion. We have a major problem in our time. And we have the feeling that unlimited money must be spent on increasing the humanistic knowledge of children. Now, one program recently dealt with the fact that vast sums have been poured into the scientific education of students, just on the lowest grades, and also, of course, on secondary and upper levels. And yet, by providing something as simple as calculators to students, they have not increased their ability to comprehend calculation. They've only made it easier for them to get answers. And the net result is that solid knowledge in the sciences or in mathematics has been diminished by this kind of approach. So we are seeing the destruction of education by their desire to make education more and more successful in terms of these humanistic goals.
Well, the public school system has lulled itself into, got itself into a trap with the computer, computerization, these computer classes. They seem to have forgotten the fact that you have to be able to think in order to build a computer. A computer, regardless of what they say, and with artificial intelligence and all of the other aspects that they claim for it, is simply an information storage and manipulating device. It can handle huge amounts of information very quickly. But as far as new concepts, conceptual thinking on its own, it's not there. I've seen large corporations in the United States that turned over all of its management processes to computers and went into bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
One very large electronics firm did that. The owners that started the company thought that they could turn over all management decisions to three computers and they could go on vacation. And within about 2 years, they had to file for bankruptcy. They forgot that the computer doesn't think, it doesn't make rational decisions, business decisions.
It is startling to me that so many of the articles in this field talk about these sources of artificial intelligence as though they were capable of taking over and running everything, that somehow they're going to be like people.
Well, it's man playing God. I mean, the whole idea of imbuing a machine with the same power of thought that a human has is ridiculous. You know, we can't think as quickly as a computer does, but a computer cannot do a lot of the things that the human mind can do.
Well, we have to recognize that there's been a tremendous retreat from this relationship of meaning and disciplines. Art for art's sake, science for science's sake, has meant also religion for religion's sake. And so you've had learning in the universities without any relationship to life. You've had churches in which the preaching is so abstract from reality that really it has no application to the world at large. You're dealing with something that is limited because the people who are controlling that area, say the preachers, have separated religion and life, the Bible and our everyday society. All they can do is to limit the meaning of the Bible and what it teaches to a very small area of life. And this is wicked.
Well, you know, money is the root of all evil, and the common thread in all of these enterprises is to get money.
Now, one of the things we need to face today, therefore, is the relevance of our faith to the world at large. How can our faith have any relevance to politics if it doesn't have any relevance to the world at large? And it has been a disaster the way the church has withdrawn from all these areas. It's been a real victory that in this past generation it has begun to regain some of the lost ground, as for example education on the primary and secondary levels, and I hope it'll continue and go to the advanced levels of education. But it has been a retreat from the world, and the world has suffered because of it. Art for art's sake is as ridiculous as religion for religion's sake, or any area attempting to vindicate its existence in terms of things within its own boundaries. Now, when we consider religion and politics, we therefore have to say, in this world, because God created it, every area of life is related to every other. And therefore, we have to, in our thinking, as Christians, emphasize the interrelationship and make sure we apply our faith to our sphere of activity and to everything else around us. I cannot forget the fact that some years ago, about 15 years ago, we were thinking of doing an entire issue of the Journal of Christian Reconstruction on theology and the world of business. It was very different from what we intended because we could not find the businessmen who were ready to relate the two. In fact, the response of many was often a rather profane one. What the blankety blank does the Bible have to do with my business, with my everyday work? Provided they didn't put a gun to your temple and rob you, as long as they were doing things on a nominally honest level, what they were doing was therefore entirely legitimate. And this is the kind of attitude that prevailed in one sphere after another, so that there were men who were in effect proclaiming evolution in their sciences while professing to believe in creation Sunday mornings. One of the things that happens when religion and politics are separated, or for that matter, any area of life and thought and the faith, if they be separated, then it steadily becomes less and less a moral concern and more of a game that people engage in. Politics becomes a game. And you have people playing the game in terms of very, very superficial concerns, ready to get away with whatever they can get away with, and ready to play a role because they have no great moral concern. Looking at Washington in recent years, we can cite a great deal of corruption since World War II at the top. And yet a sneaking suspicion that a fair number of these people enjoyed it as a game, enjoyed pulling the wool over the people's eyes, enjoyed getting away with whatever they could get away with, and that it is more and more of a game to some of these people. And now there is a resentment that some people are saying it's wrong to play this game.
Well, the yuppie generation, you know, had their own mantra. They said that the money that you made was only how you kept score. It was the manipulation of power and manipulating other people's lives that is what really interested them. And this is why the generation of the 60s and 70s is so heavily involved in politics today, because their whole end game was to exercise power over other people. And the common denominator is playing God.
Mm-hmm. Very true. The basic sin of man is to be as God.
Yeah, but they're doing a lousy
determining
job.
Determining what is good and evil.
Yeah, but they're doing a lousy job. In every area that they've delved in, they've made matters worse.
A couple areas where it's obvious that politics is a game is the talk on both sides about this, about Clinton and the whole impeachment process. They'll come up with superfluous and irrelevant things which they think might appeal or might sound good to their particular constituency, or a particular group because they're interested in defending the president or one thing. And they don't get to the heart of the matter. Well, they're not interested to. Another way is campaign ads and how superficial they are. And we talk so much about our democracy and representative government, but what it really says is Nixon talked about the silent majority, which is a term coined by Otto Scott. There's the ignorant majority who are easily misled. They are easily sidetracked. So that you can tell them it's only about sex, about Clinton, and some of them will believe it. You can give half-truths or completely erroneous information on campaign advertising, and a lot of people will buy it.
Well, they want the gravy train to continue. Let's face it, when you've got multi-million dollar retirement out there, you got to stay in the saddle. And after you have a vested interest, after a politician is vested in the pension plan, after they've been in office for one or two terms, they have to stay in the saddle. So they develop the survival instinct after about two terms. That's the reason that, you know, the people that came up with the term limits thing realized this, that people who get into politics with the finest intentions of doing, quotes, good for other people become corrupt after about two terms. And there are very few exceptions, if there are any at all. And once they get on the gravy train, they see the possibilities out there. And then they ask themselves the question, what would I be doing instead of this?
A particular point, and if you give man too much power, he's going to use it. And inevitably, he'll use that power for evil purposes.
Well, this is the problem. You know, any government, if you've got a dog catcher, you put somebody in charge of being dog catcher for a city or a town, he's got to have an administrator, somebody to watch over him to make sure he doesn't become irrational. And then you've got to have somebody over the administrator. And pretty soon you're up to the council, and then you've got a mayor, and pretty soon you've got a state government, and then you've got a federal government. And it never ends because they're all confused about who's in charge. So they keep appointing somebody above the last guy, hoping that they'll get to somebody like a king or an emperor or a president that is going to be the man on the white horse, that's going to be able to solve all their problems and run this vast empire, this vast machinery, which always falls of its own weight.
So schools are a good example of that. Public schools, at least in California, are swimming in money. The people who want more money for education are right about one thing. It's not getting to the classroom in most instances. It's not getting to the classroom. It's administrators.
Well, it becomes
the bureaucracy in Sacramento and the county and the district level who's consuming all this school revenue.
When is the last time you saw a list of the top 100 or top 500 moneymakers in just the state of California's educational bureaucracy? There are hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of people up there making well over $100,000 a year who do nothing, absolutely nothing. They're parasites. They have very little to do with what happens down in the quotes in the street, as far as education is concerned. And they don't want, once they get on the gravy train, like any other political machine, they don't want it to end because the rewards are vast.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is interesting to note that John Cotton, in his book on Revelation, written in the colonial era, saw that man is a sinner and that he is going to use any power given him to the extreme. And he summed it up in these words: every horse knows the length of his tether by morning.
Yeah.
In other words, the horse will go as far as the tether will reach, and man will go as far as his tether will reach or allow him to go.
Well, this is, you know, this is also, you can apply that same thing to technology.
Mm-hmm.
We have all of these new technologies coming online, which government monopolizes and then uses to control the people. The surveillance, the cameras everywhere, the surveillance of the internet, you know, I mean, they just can't wait. You know, the federal, all of the various federal agencies, law enforcement or otherwise, just can't wait for these new technologies because it gives them another notch on the power ladder. They can exercise more control over people's lives. They can measure every jot and tittle of every person's life, and that gives them absolute power. And they have an insatiable appetite for technology, and they'll spend any amount of money that they have to in the name of, quote, science. And it's not about science, it's about control.
I think the present direction of things is to increase the power of the bureaucracies. This will mean to increase their power over us and over our possessions. And only as men start curtailing the power of the state, curtailing the power of bureaucracies, will they begin to regain freedom in one sphere after another. And it's this progressive loss of freedom that is so devastating in our time.
Well, it's happened in the legal machinery all the way up to the Supreme Court. I heard Bork speak. He was giving a speech at some university on C-SPAN here last weekend, and he mentioned the fact that people are just beginning to realize that the court, the Supreme Court of the United States, reads the newspaper. I mean, everybody thought it was a joke back in, I don't know, in Roosevelt's time. I think some wag in the press said, well, the Supreme Court reads the daily paper. Well, in fact, they do, because the Roe v. Wade was a sop to the what they perceived as being the popular notion toward abortion. And virtually, they've been busting their buttons to come up with decisions that, regardless of how they have to stretch and manipulate the wording of the Constitution, they have, in effect, usurped the legislative power of the legislative branch of the government by this activist type of judicial decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been going on, it's been rampant for probably since the 1800s. But it's been picking up steam, it's been picking up, I mean, virtually across the board, in virtually every decision they make, they come up with wording that even law professors can't make sense of, lawyers can't make sense of, because it has no relation whatsoever to the Constitution. They're just making it up as they go along.
Well, we have to restore the priority of religion, because what our faith tells us is that all things are to be understood in terms of God, in terms of the Trinity, and that we cannot understand any area of life or thought apart from Him. As a result, any attempt to separate life from God is an attempt to separate life from meaning. And this is what we have had. And we have been fed a whole world of partial meanings, of trite answers. And this is going to stop because it will break down of itself. However, if we wait until that happens, we will certainly reap the whirlwind and the consequences.
Well, the debt bubble is another manifestation of this. It's a, you know, giant Ponzi scheme, and now it's being carried on a world scale, on a global scale, so that if one country falls, they're afraid that the entire world economic structural collapse. I mean, is this ridiculous? Absolutely ridiculous. Why, you know, if the banks in Japan go in a hole for $600 billion worth of bad loans, that the United States has to be concerned about our financial stability. Absolutely ridiculous.
Or that the answer rests purely with us, that there is no objective moral factor in economics.
Exactly. I mean, there has to be, at some point, if you are corrupt enough and you are wasteful enough, at some point you got to pay the piper.
Yes.
Every individual is faced with this, but governments feel they're exempt. And they construct these giant houses of cards in order to try to keep themselves from being exempt.
And they keep assuming that with the right kind of action in Washington, the world crisis will be solved.
Well, the government itself is in crisis from top to bottom.
Well, I think, to get back to Mrs. Thatcher's statement, until we share a similar perspective, we're not going to understand what's happening in the world, because we will see things unrelated to our faith, unrelated to God, unrelated to the basic moral laws which govern reality. And this has been our problem. We have less insight into the problems which confront us than most generations have had. We have more factual knowledge, but less insight, because we have taken a perspective which is entirely ungodly, and which is entirely without any relationship to reality.
Well, I thought up until recently that politicians who claimed that they could solve problems were simply arrogant, ignoring the lessons of history, making the same mistakes that prior governments and prior politicians have made through time, that they were simply arrogant, feeling that they alone were wise enough and intelligent enough to succeed where all prior politicians and governments had failed.
Yes.
But as I'm beginning to come to the conclusion that they're just plain stupid. It's just like a hog trying to get out of a pen, or a bear, you know. They'll just run into the side of a steel barrier and run into it and run into it and run into it as many times as it takes until they run out of energy, because they don't learn the lesson that it's impenetrable, that they cannot solve their problem by that means. And yet we have politicians who will try the same tired, failed methods time after time after time and never give up. They're afraid to give up. They're absolutely terrified to admit to their constituents that their methods are a failure. At some point, I would think that the mere frustration of failure would force any intelligent being to look for the alternative, which is the answers found in the Bible. Mm-hmm. It's the only repository of wisdom left. I mean, they've explored every other nook and cranny, every other methodology, and failed with it.
Mark, our time is running out. Do you have some comments by way of conclusion or summary that you'd like to make?
I think as we approach politics, government in general, I think we just have to recognize that man is a sinner. And we have to expect less from government, and we have to give them less power. And we can't hope for reform coming from Washington or Sacramento or any other seat of government. The only way ultimately that we're going to have reform is if we take power away from government and we demand more freedom of ourselves. And I think that's the only way things are ever ultimately going to be changed. As long as we have powerful government, we're not going to have freedom. and we're going to have chaos in politics. We're going to have this pathetic show. I think we deserve a Clinton. I think we were due for someone just like a Clinton. Can't really make a pretense to respectability.
I remember reading people predicting his rise to prominence 15, 20 years ago, that at some point near the end of the 20th century that we would have a president who was a complete, totally morally bankrupt individual. And amazingly, it's come to pass. Everybody thought it was, an off-the-wall and irrational comment to make at the time, but it has actually come to pass.
Well, 10 years ago, in 1988, he considered running for the presidency. And now people that have been associated with him have said that he chose not to because he knew with the Gary Hart scandal, he knew that was going to hit him.
Mm-hmm.
So he chose not to run then and apparently decided 4 years later, and he was correct, that he could get away with it.
Well, the power, government's power comes from money. And, if people want to keep voting for big bond issues that enslave their children, which is what they're doing, they're enslaving their children and their grandchildren for generations to come by keep voting for these huge bond issues. Education, despite what they say, does not need more money in the state of California. They need to simply spend more wisely what they have. In every area of government, people have got to, every election, they've got to stop voting for these bond issues. Because when the more money you give them, the longer the hayride's going to continue.
You mentioned one point I'd like to return to. Mark, you mentioned that the fact of church life is that too often the churches begin with, "You need Jesus," which is true enough. But even more, we need to face the fact it's not a need. We cannot live without him. All meaning is destroyed in our lives and in the world. And our problem today is we see him as the extra, the cherry on top of the dessert or the ice cream. And therefore, we do not really see our need for him as a life and death matter, but only as a kind of donum subroditum, something good that is added on to something that is basically okay. And today, our failure to appreciate why Christ is all essential for us is leading us to underrate the importance of the faith, its total world and life controlling perspective, and the extent of our need of redemption in terms of the whole Word of God. Well, our time is up. I want to encourage those of you who have subjects you'd like to have us discuss to write. Meanwhile, God bless you all, and we pray that you will in these difficult times not only survive but grow in grace and understanding and prosper in Christ.